if you would state your name and your date of birth.
Okay, I'm James Patrick Fitzgerald. I was born December 23rd, 1918 in La Grande, Oregon.
Uh-huh. And as you grew up here, where did you go to school?
Well, I started out where I was born. I was born on the corner of 6th and Penn, in a house now occupied by the Potter's Shed, or whatever they call that place over there, and right across the street from Dale Mammon's office. And I started school when I was 5 years old at the Sacred Heart Academy and up on the hill where the old St. Joseph Hospital area is now. I attended there 4 years. I went 1 year at Central School. And then I guess all of the towns ne'er-do-wells, they bunched them in one big bunch and sent them all to Ackerman School when it opened in 1929. So we had quite a bunch of kids from all over the area that went there. Now, what else you need?
And then when you graduated from Ackerman, you went on to high school?
High school here, yeah. Graduated there in 1936.
Is there any particular things that happened to you when you were going to school that you'd like to share with us?
Well, lots of things happened over the years. I suppose the years up until the time I went to Ackerman School, that was a school that was run by the college up there, J.H. Ackerman. And I went there from, the sixth grade to the eighth. And that particular 3 years seemed to me like the highlight of my school up to that time because of the fine people that we were able to meet and be associated with over a long time, over our whole lives. Namely, Elmo Stevenson and his wife, who had just come up here from San Jose, California, to teach here. And Elmo was an outstanding educator, as far as I was concerned, in my whole life, and his wife, too. And I think I learned more, and they guided my life more in those years that I knew them so well. And we kept in contact with them throughout our entire lives after Elmo left here and became president of Southern Oregon College at Albany, down from Medford, Southern Oregon College.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was there for quite a long time and we kept contact with him at that time. And they are both passed away now, but they affected my whole life more than anybody that I ever came in contact with as far as education was concerned.
Anything outstanding happened when you went to high school?
Well, the night that the school burned, up there, I forget, that was the fall of, I entered high school in 1932, so it was in the fall of, just before school started in 1932, one of our local firemen volunteers, I guess he set the place on fire on purpose, but I can remember every kid in town up there was going into that burning school and hauling everything off the old basement floor was the first floor, and we hauled the entire library out of there and put on old J.H. Blunt's front porch, all the books, stacked them up on his front porch, and in his house and every place else the night that he lived just across, right across from the fire. Mm-hmm. And we were wading in water up there, after getting all that out of there, so I guess that was the most
exciting
part there. But
Then they had to have you go around to the different churches.
Yeah,
to
we went to...
While
they
rebuilt.
I always remember that because we still lived on the corner of 6th and Penn there at that time, and I'd stepped on a nail out in my yard and went clear through my foot, came out the top, and that got infected. And I started my school year after that. By the time I got going to school, I was on crutches, going from the old high school building area down to the Mormon church and down to about where the post office is now, the old Honan Hall that used to be down there. We had classes there and we had classes at the city building. And I think that was the three main places we had to go, but they were all over town. But those were exciting years as far as going to school and chasing all over town for the whole year before we got back into the school. I think most people realize they took the third floor off of the high school and lowered it to what was then a two-story building. And we made do with that.
Start this again. In high school, was there any particular subjects you liked better than?
Well, biology and chemistry, and then I rather liked civics, which is unusual for anybody to like in those days. But we had a fellow, Ken something, like his name escapes me right now, but he was a very interesting fellow, and we had some pretty good set to some arguments in our class, and he made us participate, and we got a lot out of us that way.
Yeah, I can see that. When you graduated from high school, then what did you do then?
Well, I went to work for my brother, and my father had passed away in 1935, and that was right in the depth of the Depression, and any hopes of college was just completely out at that particular time, and my mother was older, and so I lived with her in various apartments around town. She seemed to like to move every once in a while, so I really didn't have what they'd call a home after that time, and for quite a while. And Ed had a furniture store there on the corner of Adams and Fur, where I guess you call it the Rouse Building now, but it was a car building. That building was built, it's on the front of the building there. 1924 it was, there, and by, I cannot say the name of the person that built the building. Anyway, he started in that store working for Joe Carr in 1928, and then there were a series of happenings over the years, so Ed ended up being the owner of it, and I went right to work for him, and then basically the Depression was really hard on everyone, and there just was not much chance even for that furniture store at the time, but he worked hard at it, and he was making quite a success out of it. And so I worked there in 1942, and he sold the store, and he and I both joined the Navy, and that was the end of the furniture store. So I was in the Navy briefly, it wasn't in too long. And I came out on a disability discharge, and about that time the cadet program was starting up at the college, and I happened to come back to town to look into the Ed was gone, and my brother, and not in the country, and so I kind of took over looking at what was happening at that locked up business and so on for a little while. It just happened that Bob Williamson and what was the guy that managed the park on it? Bud Olson.
Bud Olson.
They came to me up the house there one day. It wasn't too long after I got back, and they said, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I don't really know, but I said I was thinking about going down and joining the Merchant Marine in Portland." So they said, "Well, we got a better offer for you, and they want you up to college." And they were just getting that program started for the cadets, and so I helped as I could in getting people, you know, where they're supposed to be and getting the whole thing started. And then under the other people who were up there, and then I worked with Bob Quinn for the next 14 months, and the cadet there in the what do they call that?
ROTC?
There's a name for it, of course.
Had to do with athletics.
It was just physical fitness and all that, and record keeping, and so that was. I'd known Bob here forever, and when his family first came to town in 29 to get him back to the Ackerman business again, we had a real fine athletic teacher for a bunch of kids at that school. And so anyway, Bob and Helen were real close friends of ours, the kids. So I kind of worked out the rest of the war up there.
And when were you and Helen married?
Well, September 3rd, 1939.
Oh, wow.
I told her there two wars started that day, that mine was going to last a lot longer than hers, and the other one we'd be done without before, you know. So we're still fighting, so.
Well, when did you buy Rohan's
1945. Uh-huh. I bought the old Rohan flower shop, which was located on Depot Street at the time, and then they had the old greenhouse up in Old Town. And we had that, and the rest is history as far as we're still chasing around planting flowers. I don't know how I got into this gardening and flower business, but from a standpoint of personal choice, but somewhere in the back of my mind, away long years ago, somebody gave me a package of flower seeds. When we still lived there on 6th Street. And my dad and my mother had absolutely no idea of planting anything. They just were too busy trying to make a living, I guess, or whatever, but there was nobody in the family that ever had one idea about fooling around growing anything. They want something to put out in the yard or up the cemetery or someplace. They went and bought it. But anyway, I planted those seeds and I didn't have a bit of luck with them, but I guess that's where it started. But anyway, I've been doing this ever since. Does landscaping, and only landscaped the new Grand Round Hospital the first time. They tear it up every 5 minutes up there, but we landscaped that whole place, and we had a contract with Standard Oil for quite a while doing their, what they call their superstation. For one of them here on Adams, here on Highland City Strip, still there, but we did a number of those around over the country for them, and a lot of, quite a bit of commercial work, and some houses. We didn't go in too much into homes, and, although let's say we did quite a few of them, but anyhow, Mom and I, we both got into these flowers and everything. You can see out here, we're still working at it.
What year did you move from G Avenue up there?
Out here, 50 years ago. 50 years ago this October.
Mm-hmm. Then your flower shop caught on fire. What year was that on Adams?
I can't tell you the exact year. Mom could. What happened there? Gordon something had a bakery there, and Philo Staker had a photo album. I had the flower shop. I was just looking in your book there, the pictures. I see the picture of the Golden Rule store. That's where it was located. And then Rhodes Lewis had a store just next to us, which is a wine store place, which had been a creamery at one time or another. The old Antioch West area, I think, started that. The place where they had ice cream and milk and all the butter and all stuff you buy there. Well, anyway, those all wiped out in that fire. But as I recall it, somebody called me from the annex and said, "Pat, they called me out here." I moved out here then. They called me at home on a Sunday morning. Said, "You better get in town, that your flower shop's on fire." So we got up, and it was the day after Valentine's Day. And we got in there, and of course, the flower shop wasn't where the fire started.
The fire started in the bakery.
I get into one. Anyway, the bakery is what set the place off, and there was no, the way that building was built, it was just one big unfinished basement there, around there with rock walls that to kind of light them off to hold the building up. And the fire just traveled right under the place, and they didn't think they'd go save the town that day. Just like I did, if the wind had been blowing on the day of the fire the way it was on Valentine's Day, there wouldn't have been anything to be up Adams Avenue for it. They thought we're glad the old glass drug on it. They thought that was all going to burn.
Well, it burned pretty good.
Yeah, but they did. They did get it stopped. So then we moved over to the Moon Building, where the old Stephen Van England store was. And Rhodes Lewis and I told him, we were talking about what we were going to do, and I said, "Well, let's see if we can't find something." Well, I called the Moons and had that building rented before the fire was out. So we were there for, I don't remember just how long, but a few years. And these people had bought the building from the Moons. So every time I turned around, they'd raise my rent. And they got me real mad one day, and I stormed out the front door and was going to go up to Powell Graham's drugstore and have a cup of coffee, try to cool off. And I looked down the street, looked over there, and saw the old building where we are now. That's where Roy Farnham had his store. It was an auto supply store, and it was empty. Goss had moved them out because he was going to put in a small car dealership. That was Bill, and the family was mad at him. So I went out. I just turned, instead of turning right down the street, I turned left. Went across down to Goss's garage, and I said, "What the hell are you going to do with that building over there?" And he gives me a sad story about the whole family was mad at him and this and that.
Well, okay.
So, anyway, we had a conversation over the hood of a car for about 25 or 30 minutes, and I told him what I was going to do with the building if I could give it to me to get a hold of, and he said, "Okay." So, 45 minutes, I had no place to put that where we are now.
So That's how it came to be Pat Sally.
That's how it came to be Pat Sally. It's been a good place for us. I think it's been good for the town.
Well, it's a central location.
Yeah.
Well, in the changes around LeGrand, what do you think of the way things have gone, Pat?
Well, you know, I think that being here as long as I have and the way I've seen things, I can remember one time telling the bank manager, Arch Parker, when he was here. I was a young, smart like kid, and I said, I thought the whole damn place was going to hell. As far as and that is many words. And he laughed, and he said, well, it was before you got here, and he said, it might be here after you leave. I said, well, that might be. But anyway, there's been a lot of changes, some for the better, some, I don't think, not for the better. And but my wife and I, and well, a family, in a family business the way it is, we discuss it quite often about how to stay in business. And that's a good question these days, with all of the competition and the way things have changed, when I look at the way the different businesses operate in LeGrand, for instance, going back to the furniture store days, my brother had that store, everything was on an exclusive basis. You had certain lines that were yours exclusively, and nobody else had them. That was the law of the land, and then that Fair Trade Act was thrown out, and so now everybody has everything. And when I look at these box stores, as you call them, I don't particularly care to be in them. But they've got everything in God's green earth there to sell to you at a price. And it's getting exceedingly hard for the small businessman to hold on. And I don't know, when I look at the different people that were in, say, in the grocery business, or take any business in town, that were in business, say, 25, 30, 40, 50 years ago, most of them are working for the big boys anymore. And that's the only choice they have, if they want to stay around here or go someplace and work for the big outfit.
Every neighborhood had a little grocery store.
Oh, my goodness, yes. There was one. Nobody wanted to walk more than 5 minutes to get to it. Grocery store. I had to laugh at my brother-in-law, Helen's sister. He says, well, Carolyn can't do business in a town as safe way as far as 15 minutes away. I don't know what she's going to do now because it's further than 15 minutes from where she lives. So, things have changed a lot. And who's to say with it?
And the railroad moving, didn't that make a lot of difference?
Yes, that was an awful jolt. And the railroad was just something special to everybody because a railroad engineer, to most of the kids around the ground, that was the highest, most valued job in the world if you could just be a railroad engineer. And that was when that all left and everything was gone. It used to be over there in those yards. It was very difficult to there, but maybe Arch Parker was right. See, something else came in and took its place, and it didn't take its place, but it filled in, and now you got all kinds of different things. Maybe none as grand as the railroad you seem to be, but people look at you and shake your head when they say, well, we used to have 6 passenger trains going each way a day here. Well, that's hard to believe. At one time there were 6 trains in either direction. And now you can't even keep one running. But
when the roundhouse went, you know, the picture that showed everybody on the turntable,
oh, yeah.
There must have been 250 people worked in the yards and shops.
Everybody, that was the railroad and the mill people, that was the backbone of all of the businesses in town. There wasn't a lot else here. And when August Stang came to town with his families, and put that mill over there, and the old Bowman Hicks was up there where the fairgrounds is, and those were two big employers around here, and most everybody, I still got lots of friends, and people were in my class when they graduated, they didn't have to work in high school, they never thought about where they were going to go to work, they went right to work in the mill. And if you were, that was kind of politically correct in those days, if your dad was an engineer, you were on the ground floor to be an engineer. It's pretty hard to break into that if you didn't, part of that culture, you might start out doing some menial job and get ahead, but mostly, if you go question any kid that was an engineer in later years, well, that's because my dad was an engineer.
I can appreciate that.
And that's how that worked.
Or a conductor.
Yeah.
In those days, they had a number of brakemen on every train.
Yeah.
They've cut it down now. All you have is an engineer and a conductor.
I don't, those winters over the hill here, I don't blame anybody for not wanting to be a brakeman on top of the walk the length of those trains in those snowstorms in the dead of winter. And it was worth your life to get out of the caboose and get up on top.
They don't do that anymore.
No. But it was still, just that kind of a thing that if you were part of that railroad family, that's the way it was. You just, their kids all had a job. But anyhow, there's been such a difference in the way everything's done. Of course, with their farming and ranching, my father's whole work here in the valley was when he came here was he built the Grand Iron Works, which is down there. He owned the land where the underpass went through, and it kind of cut him off because the highway at that time went right by his front door down Cove Avenue. And when they put that underpass in, cut that all out, it isolated him down there, didn't help him a bit for customers and things. But anyway, his main job was catering to the, mills and railroad. He actually, at times, in later years, he didn't, but in the early times, he had a siding there where his business was, where they brought the engines in. Like the old railroad run from Union to Hot Lake, or out to Cold, and then Union Junction. He repaired those engines and kept those. They're pretty smaller outfits around there.
What other kind of works did they do at the ironworks?
Well, he had a foundry.
Uh-huh.
And they made all the brake shoes for the trains, for the logging trains. And he made bearings. It's hard for anybody to believe this nowadays, but if you were out harvesting in the field, whatever you were doing, you didn't go to Roy Farnham or some parts house and get a part. You came to Dave Fitzgerald and he made the part for you. And he had a very extensive pattern inventory list there where he could make any kind of a bearing. He made them out of old Babbitt and brass, all kinds of metal. They had a place where they did all that kind of work. And they made the bearing. That's what kept these things out here breaking down. That's where you went to get them fixed. And he worked mostly in Union with a lot of county.
When'd your dad come here?
Pardon?
When did he come to the railroad?
Well, he was born in Port Huron, Michigan, but he was a Canadian, but he had dual citizenship. his family came, I think it was 1856, I think, in the time frame somewhere. They came to Ottawa, Canada, from Ireland and Scotland. And they landed at Ottawa. And then they moved to Toronto. And this is hard to believe, he was born in 1863. He was 57 years old when I was born. I must have been the biggest shock anybody ever got. But he came here the first time to the valley. He was sent by a French company that owned gold mining claims up way up the Grand Ronde River. And what was called the French diggings in those days. And Dad spoke both French and English, and they sent him out here to set that thing up. They called the Indiana mine later, and then the Carson mine. Yeah. Well, anyway, he went back to Canada, and my father, my grandfather, and grandmother, they had 9 children. I don't know exactly, I've got a list of all the children, I know who was born where, when, either in Canada or in the old country. But anyhow, he was the only one that ever came here and stayed permanently. But he came down here, he met my mother in Lewiston, Idaho, and they got married over there, and then he had a machine shop and foundry and blacksmith shop in Dayton, Washington. And he was there, my sister Mary was the youngest child. She was born in Dayton, Washington in 1902. So he was there then, and I don't know exactly. Clark, my closest brother, he was four years older. And Mary was, but he was born on the ground. So in that time frame, he had moved over here. And his first business was, I've got a picture of it out in the shed there, was right where the OTEC office is on Elma Street. He owned that half of that half block. And he built his first business there, which the streets weren't paved. And I don't know what else, I've got a picture of the business. Whatever this thing he was building was some kind of a thing that drove pipes in the ground for wells. They got that out in front of the building. If you want to look at it after a while, we'll get that out and you can see it. Might be an interesting picture for you.
Yes, I'd like to see it.
And, anyway, he was there, and I don't know exactly when he moved out on Cove Avenue, but old Earl Van Blocklin, you know, he's quite a writer. He worked for my dad in the wintertime and farmed on the family farm in the summertime. And Earl called me some long years ago. He said, "Pat, when did your dad build that building out there where the business was?" And I told him, I said, "I don't know." I said, "All I knew that the building burned down twice, once in 1923 and once in 1925. And I said, "I assumed that maybe 1921 or something." He said, "No." He said, "It was longer ago than that." And I said, "Well, I don't know then." "Well," he said, I said, "what do you know?" He said, "Well, I do know that the day you were born was in the wintertime of December 1918, and your dad came through the big business, came through handing out cigars for his new son." He said, "That was 1918, wasn't it?" I said, "Yeah." "Well," he said, "that building was out there then." Well, I said, okay, I'll agree with you. But anyhow, he located out there, but till he passed away in 1935, January 1935, and he was in there continuously from whatever time they started, 1904, 6, whatever, I don't know here, until he passed away in 1935.
Now, did he have to build some railroad bridges through the...
Yeah, the old bridge that used to cross when the highway, the old way you used to get out of town, you went down to the corner of Adams and 2nd, across the 2nd Street Viaduct, go down to Y Avenue and turn left, and then you crawl around the railroad tracks and cross the bridge.
Out there by Walt Sweets.
Yeah, he built that bridge. And then the road went there, and then he built one or two of those iron, I know one for sure, maybe they have both of them, the iron bridges that cross in Perry. There were two crossings there, and we built a lot of bridges around different places, you know, just out these early bridges around here, all those iron things just all stuck around all over the valley. He was responsible for a lot of those.
And Vince, where did the highway go after it crossed the river? Did it, about
which,
where's
which
that
river?
Now?
Where?
The highway. Highway, the main highway, leaving
LeGrand. Oh, well, it, like I say, went over the 2nd Street Viaduct, go down to Y Avenue and turned left, and then you followed right along the river and crossed the bridge that went up Fox Hill, that this road did. And it, but it made a sharp left right there and crawled out of the valley, and or out of the canyon, up through there to... there was a bridge, after you went through Perry, you crossed that bridge at Perry and then made, went on through, down path for that Garrity lady, I can't say her name now. She and Chet still lived there at that house after the bridge was gone. You followed around on the other side of the river, that went by Hamilton Canyon up there, and you crossed the river there.
Up there by Mountain Springs.
Yeah, you made a right-hand turn and went down there. And then you went down to where Harlan Noyes' dad, Mom, they had a little house or a little cabin for summertime there. And you crossed the bridge and went back across the river again.
Yeah.
And then well, then you started up, yeah, you started, you went up by 5 points, then right. You went on up by the stump patch and went over there. And then went on up to the Camila. But, that road that used to the old, and you went up to Hillgard. There was a road went through there on Pelican Creek.
Mm-hmm.
You went up Pelican Creek and turned right and went under the railroad track. And you went up a ways, not very far, crawling up that canyon. And that's where the old Harding family, Cora Harding.
I remember the name.
Yeah,
yes,
Cora Harding.
Yeah.
Her,
she worked for the East Marine Electric, didn't she?
No, she worked for...
Hello.
Hi. Harding had a stagecoach stop right at the bottom of it. Have you ever gone through there? Where you going?
One time, but not a long time ago.
You go up, and right here was Harding's stagecoach block.
Mm-hmm.
You made a sharp left and you went up on top. And did you ever remember Harley Smith that had the poultry feed?
I knew the name.
Past your time.
Yeah.
Well, right there on Jefferson, where Goss has that new building he put in there. Mm-hmm. That was the old Standard Water building. He had feet and
later, Eddie. And Fritz.
Hoffman.
Hoffman.
Well, he went up on that flat, and he that's where Harley was raised. And there was a cabin there. We used to, after my dad died, Harley was kind of my dad. And we'd go up there to that place, and Harley raised turkeys. And Frank George, who used to raise chickens, had a chicken hatchery over here on Fruitvale Road, just this, up this way from where Jim Bowles lives, just this side. House is still there. Still looks like a hatchery, but somebody made it over and made it into the house. But anyway, Frank stayed up there and took care of the turkeys. He took them out, they run all the damn flat out there and eat grasshoppers and everything else, you know. And they'd bring them in there at night and had a big pen, put them in there so the coyotes wouldn't get them. Anyway, I'd go up, Harley would take me up. We'd go up every weekend. Frank was up there batching all by himself. He was a widower. Batching, he had to cook for himself all week. So I got named the kitchen bitch. And I was a cook. A pretty good cook. Anyway, I was a kitchen bitch. And so we'd relieve Frank for the weekend. We had some good times up there, but Frank or Harley used to talk about when he was a kid. This is going way back before the turn of the in the late 1800s. They were putting the Indians on the reservation.
Uh-huh.
There was a little front stoop on the front of that cabin, just a little square, just a He said I'd sit there and see those. All those poor Indians, just the most bedraggled-looking people there, so I'll take them and put them on the radio. He says, I was still afraid of them. Even as a little kid, even though they're all on foot, most of them, and dragging them over there, he said, I thought about how sad it was after that. That's getting kind of a ways back, isn't it?
Yeah. A couple of days back. But do you remember the Indians coming over the hill to collect
camas out? Out at Spruce's.
Uh-huh.
We were talking about that there night. John took Julie out to see the camas moon. And I said, I knew the news and love of the Indians. I knew you remember the Connor family over there? Gilbert and
Heard the name.
Oh, Leah. She's some hot shot with the reservation now. And Ray, he's the chief, he's about that big around. Boy, Melissa, my niece, and I, we were over at the roundup. We came in there, and here's Ray standing out there by this tent, or teepee, all dressed in pure white, beautiful outfit. Everything. But he's about that big around. And I look at him, Ray, what in the hell have you been eating? I am getting kind of big, but he went to Eastern Oregon, he graduated, Leah graduated up here, and Ray taught school in North Powder, and he taught Melissa Joseph, she's my niece.
Mm-hmm.
He taught her and Bob, her brothers, and Leah was down at the Warm Spring Reservation in charge of that for a long time.
They had an Indian program early in the East.
That. I got such a kick out of her because she was supposed to get those Indian kids to school in Wasco. And so they called her in there and said, Leah, what are we going to do? The kids just come and go. She said, what do you expect? She said, if you can get them to come here for an hour or a half hour and they just get up and walk out, just be glad you had them that length of time. They'll come back. Well, and the church has got to hollering at her about the Indians would promise to come to church. And so they said, well, what time do you hold church? Well, 11 o'clock, like everybody does. Well, she said, not like Indians. She said, if you want to go, they'll come to church. Yeah, out here on the mountain at dawn. You meet them out there and they'll be there. But you better just give up because you're not going to make any more. Gilbert was a Presbyterian, and he was on the session over there, and they'd come over here. I kept them in contact. Olicott.
Well, they have their own timetable.
Oh, yeah.
People don't understand that.
No. Well, I rode these mountains with a lot of them for a long time and over the years. And I was reading some of the stuff I wrote down here like some time ago about some of the trips we took with those people, and it was something else. It's really a privilege to know them, you know.
Oh, it is.
Just such great people. And when you get on my wife's side of the family, they have a lot of connection with, Fred Nodine. You've probably heard of him.
Yes.
Well, Fred owned that land where Hawkins has that land now, or the...
Mm-hmm. Out there by the Davis property.
Well, yeah, it was Dave.
Pete,
yeah,
and R.B.
Yeah, but Granddad Hall, that's Helen's grandfather, owned that. He bought all that land. And all that. You'll end up doing your own grandma, which I start telling you this stuff. But anyway, that side of the family. That Fred Nodine, even though he accumulated quite a bit, but he couldn't keep anything. He lost every damn thing. He just wasn't a very good businessman. And he got wound up with over here on the ridge where Joseph put all those poles up to mark where you're not supposed to come, or is that our land?
I didn't know about that.
Oh, well, when the White started coming into the Loa Valley and started to infringe, he still didn't want to have problems with them, and they were trying to get along with him. So it got a little much, so he went up and they made rock cairns up there, and they stuck poles in them. And they were all along that ridge that crossed Cricket Flat out there, and I don't know where it all went, but I knew where those were. And that was supposed to be it. Well, Fred was looking for pasture for his horse. He had a hell of a bunch of horses. And he went out there someplace, I suppose, crossing Creek Flat and taking the old route across over Smith Mountain to get over in that country. He got over there and got looking pretty hot because he started meeting bands of Indians that didn't, you know, they didn't bother him, but they weren't very friendly either. So he turned around and got the hell out of there. And that's when Granddad Hall bought the land from Fred Nodine, that piece of ground. And that, the Indians didn't give any trouble to people down here, I know of, except that so-called battle in the Grand Round. I've heard enough different lies about that, I don't know what to believe.
But I don't think anybody did.
But anyway, the Indians, they came all a long time. There when I was, in the 20s, late mid-20s, I was big enough to be out and around, the Indian be over there. But those mostly were Umatillas and Cayuse and those people from over there.
Across the mountain.
Yeah. That, those cakes they made out of that camas root. Did you ever try any of those?
Uh-huh. I've been up to the Indian program at the Eastern.
Yeah, they're pretty good, aren't they?
Pretty good, yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mix those with berries and have all kind of stuff all the way to fix them. But
I don't know, there's places up there on the Cricket Flat where camas could grow.
They said they used to gather a lot of it out there, but the place is all dried up now, except for a few potholes around. I don't know if there's any camas left up there or not, but they said that used to just be a blaze of camas.
Well, they said that they collected it out at the Smoots property, even into World War II, that the Indians had come across.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they always did.
And I've seen pictures that May Stearns took of
up
at Cove where they came over to get the fruit over at Cove.
I'll show you a picture of May Stearns. We're one of the second people that ever owned this place.
Oh.
And part of it is no direct relationship except shirt tail relations. Mm-hmm. And my Helen's dad, Merton Davis.
Uh-huh.
And Walter Pierce's son.
I remember there were two boys, weren't there? Walter.
No, I'm going about your head of generation.
Oh, okay.
Lloyd and Catherine Pierce. Catherine Riddle got married in this house.
Oh.
Lloyd and Merton were best buddies, went to World War I together, served Pierce through World War I. And when they got back, he married Catherine right there in that room, just to the right of where that television set sits.
Oh.
And he was the best man.
Uh-huh.
And then Lloyd's sister married Helen's mother's brother.
Oh.
And then Bill Douglas, the Supreme Court Justice, he married Mildred.
Yes, I remember her and him both.
Well, his room is right upstairs. This girl just came in here. She's here for the summer with us. That's our son Brian's daughter. That room up there, that was Bill's room.
Uh-huh.
So I get the hell out of Shay. If Bill gets to stomping around raising hell up there in that attic, just get him to break it off. You got to get some sleep. So we've been kind of... So anyway, I said, you know, Bill he's around here. I see him all the time. But we carried on one hell of a correspondence about these trees here and all this stuff. He was a naturalist you would not believe.
He was a nice man, as I recall.
Yeah.
I met him up at Lapover.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, right here, this was a woodshed. And there's a chimney came right down right here, and the wood range sat over here. And Mildred wanted the wood range out of the house. It was a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I bought this place from Catherine, it was lock, stock, and barrel, but Mildred thought she wanted that damn stove. And I didn't want to give it to her, but then I said, well, we're going to argue that. So she didn't come and get it, and didn't come and get it. And this thing, the chimney sitting on a jack, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know,
thank you.
And here this wall. And I had this all torn up and was building all this back in. I did most of the work in this place except for... I had a carpenter out here 2 weeks, tell me. Well, anyway, I'm looking at that damn pile of bricks up there and I wanted it out of the way. So I hooked a chain on it and there was no door here. It was just open. I hooked that chain on that damn jack and pulled it, and all the bricks came down, piling right in there, all over the top of that stove. Worst mess you ever saw. And here comes Mildred. She's building that. She and they were building that big house up there, log house, Lost Team. And she walked in there and looked at it. I said, well, what happened? I said, well, what the hell did it look like happened? I got tired of those damn bricks being up there. I've got to have this space. Miller's been telling you that for a month. So anyhow, then Well, how are we going to get it out of there? I said, I don't know how you're going to get it out of there, but I'm not getting it out of there, period. And she had some dumb kid, and it had a truck that was that high off the ground on the bed. And I don't know how we finally got the bricks out of there and finally got the stove. And here this hell, 10 people couldn't lift that stove up on that truck. Finally got it on there. And so...
Anyway. Well, Pat, you were pretty close to Carl Helm, weren't you?
Yeah.
He lived next door to you?
Let's see, where... Oh, let's see, where did he... lived a lot of places. I can't remember... This would have been... See, my sister, Mary, graduated from Oregon State College in what they called a 2-year degree in secretarial or whatever at that time. She went down to Oregon State. And she got her certificate to be a legal secretary. She and Helman Dixon she was Carl's legal secretary for years and years and years. I can't remember exactly where Carl lived.
Well, now, didn't you tell me that... Am I thinking of the right person? The policeman got shot.
Spud Helm.
Spud Helm.
Oh, Spud, Carl. Spud Helm, yeah.
Spud Helm.
They did.
Your dad was still alive then, wasn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, it still hurts. Yeah, I got a picture. I looked out in the shed or in the... Oh, no, it's in your book. There's the picture of the... mobile station that Andy Lee had there on the corner.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, just as luck would have, if you want to call it luck. Dad and I had gone over to you again for some reason or another. Spud and Captain Noel had been looking for these people, and they pulled up to where the Texaco station is, right across the street. Mm-hmm. Still there at Texaco. And Dad and I just happened to be, we'd come back from Union, and we stopped right there across the street from that Texaco station facing West on Adams. There was all this crowd of people around. And we got out of the car and went over to Andy's service station, and Spud was on a stretcher. And he was conscious. And he was supposed to come to dinner at the house that day, our house. And he said, "Well, Dave, I guess I won't make it to dinner today." And they took him to the hospital. I think he would have lived nowadays because it had more to do for people, and he died of an infection.
Had antibiotics, he might have lived.
It was 82 days, I think it was. 85, something like that.
Ree Sims was in there having Tommy Sims.
Mm-hmm.
Ree Sims was in having Tommy Sims when they brought Spud in.
Yeah.
And she talked to him you didn't want him to cut off his boots. He had a brand new pair of boots. And he was really mad at him because he...
Well, you know, he was my mentor. He was a semi-pro baseball player.
Oh.
And Helen's uncle, as it turned out, he wasn't there, Arthur Lynn. He was a semi-pro here in the Grand. And they all played up at the... where the high school was. That brick building that used to be the mechanical drawing, and that one still stands there.
Yeah.
There was a stadium or grandstand right there, kind of faced that way, looking back toward the mountain. And we used to, you know, everybody used to go to the baseball games. Bud was a second baseman anyway. I had his mitt for years, and he gave me a watch and a baseball. And I don't know what the hell ever happened to any of that. When I left, we packed everything up after the war. We had a big barrel, and we stuck a bunch of stuff in there that I didn't want anything done with, put in the basement of the furniture store. You know, so we got back, could be there. All that and a lot of other stuff disappeared. So I lost my mitt, my ball, my watch.
But, yeah.
Did you remember the Gregory Stables out here?
Price, what was his
Joe
name?
Bob Price.
Yeah, Joe Bob. They brought him out here from the flatland someplace, Kansas or Missouri or wherever now. He was probably one of the top horse men in the country when Dr. Gregory Holloway. You know Dr. Gregory and Dr. Hahn and Bill Allen ran the drugstore in Lahore. The three of them came out here and took over Hot Lake, and Dr. Branner and Dr. Ross. Conley. She was married to Ross. Anyway, they ran that for a few years.
I remember Philo Staker going out and taking pictures of the fine horses that Dr. Green had.
Oh, yeah. Well, Joe Bob, he was...